This is John Beebe, Trauma and Psychological Creativity, January 21st, 2011. This is the soundtrack off a DVD.
It was my pleasure to work with Dr. John Beebe over the past year. As you know, we plan ahead a year or so in advance so that we can get quality speakers. And Dr. John Beebe has graced us since the 80s with visiting the Jung Society in Seattle. And Dr. John Beebe is a psychiatrist based out of San Francisco and has been a long specialist in Jungian psychotherapy and is trained at and is now senior member, analyst member of the C.G. Jung Institute of San Francisco. And he was the Institute's president during 2000 to 2002, and he founded the Institute's quarterly publication, the San Francisco Jung Institute Library Journal, which we do have in our library here. And it's undergone different names, and there are different variations of that. And it's published by the University of California Press. And let's see. We also have publications and books authored and co-authored by Dr. John Beebe, including Psychiatrist Treatment, Crisis, Clinic and Consultation, Integrity and Depth, and other publications. And so a warm welcome for Dr. John Beebe.
Thank you, Anne. It's been quite wonderful this past year, holding me to the task of coming back to Seattle. Very pleasant assignment for me. We're going to talk about trauma and psychological creativity tonight, and I'm going to try to get at it in a variety of ways, some of them standing up and just talking to you, some reading a kind of statement that I prepared for a particular occasion, which was a panel of Freudians and Jungians getting together at an International Psychoanalytic Association Congress for one of the very first times since the Jungians walked out and became the Jungians back in 1914, I guess. And that was in the healing city of Rio de Janeiro. So I was so happy to have a chance to go there and give that statement. So I came up with something that I thought would be interesting to Freudian colleagues. And I will also use the medium that I find more and more teaches me everything I need to know about the psyche that we can't already get from reading the collected works of C.G. Jung and the Red Book and all the other books that are coming to supplement and complement the collected works. And that is the medium of film. I keep learning psychology from the movies, and the more I look at the movies by the truly great directors, I feel that they are also Freud and Jung. They are also the masters of psyche who somehow have made it possible if we can only learn and contemplate. So in a way, the whole evening is going to be an exercise in contemplation, and we're going to take that tomorrow to the workshop where I'm going to show you a whole film about trauma, possibly the greatest film about trauma ever made, and that's the famous film Rashomon. It took me a long time to realize that what Rashomon is about is trauma. And it's nothing but about trauma, and it's nothing about but what the psyche does and doesn't do well in the face of trauma. Fascinating film from immediate post-war Japan. And if any place on the face of the earth suffered trauma without moral high ground at the moment of the trauma being suffered, it was Japan right after the war. And this 1950 film by Kurosawa is a very, very beautiful example of psychological creativity in the face of trauma or emerging out of trauma. And in fact, it inaugurated a serious interest in the Japanese cinema all over the world. So it was actually a creative revival of Japanese culture, one of the most successful revivals of a defeated culture's reassertion of its creative imaginal power. And it really a very, very interesting document sociologically and therapeutically, as well as a really primo work of art. So I hope as many of you as possible have the time and can come to the workshop, because it's going to extend what we're doing today. But it too will be an exercise in contemplation, because it will begin with really showing the film. It's not a terribly long film, but it's over an hour and a half of viewing time, or about an hour and a half of viewing time. And in the afternoon, we'll basically spend the afternoon discussing what we've seen, felt, imagined, so, what we can learn about rising to the occasion of trauma. And I think this is a very good way to learn, it's a very good way for me to teach. The truth is that although there are many, many experts about trauma, in fact, we don't know as much as we think we know. And in her magnificent book published by the University of Chicago Press, the intellectual historian Ruth Leys, L-E-Y-S, goes over all the various theories of trauma that have come and gone over many, many vicissitudes since Freud really put the subject on the table in his very earliest work. And with all we went through as psychotherapists in the 1980s, where practically everyone alive began to feel like they had been abused, and so we really had a long, long roll of the dice with deciding what was trauma, what was not trauma. She concludes that the only truly therapeutic stance that can be justified based on the long history of people who've tried to intervene, and always, I think, not just to get glory for themselves, but to really help patients, that we have to take a pragmatic approach. We have to be very much case by case, very much ad hoc. Every story is different. Every person's trauma is different. Every person's family is different. Every person's story is different. And we just have to be as pragmatic and as multidisciplinary. And there isn't one formula of trauma. So given that that's the case, I'm in that happy Jungian position of being able to let images and experience teach us, and that's why I'm going to rely quite a lot on aesthetic modes where we can actually experience trauma not as something that can be rationally unpacked, but something that really has to almost be irrationally experienced, and then we have to sort of assess with our rational functions how helpful and unhelpful the various solutions are that people have come up with in managing trauma. So this is basically simply sharing with you a kind of distillation of what my mind is like as I do psychotherapy 5 days a week, because I'm sitting with people and it's always a mixed bag. How good is the solution that the person is coming up with at this particular moment in time? Sometimes I'm just bowled away by the creativity of people. Other times I'm rather disappointed with the neurotic artistry that is used to kind of get us in a way of thinking and a way of feeling that's only going to create more trouble down the road. And what do I do about that? And how good are my interventions anyway? And all the things that we go through. So If you think that, as I have thought, and I'm sure half of you in the room, this has occurred to at one time or another, if you pay attention to language as a source of information, I think you know that the word dream, Traum, and trauma are the same thing. And if our dreams teach us anything, it's how easily the psyche is traumatized, how many small as well as large things can upset the psyche. And in many cultures, the very fact of having a dream is already considered a sign that something's happened and there's an effort to restore balance, that the psyche's been thrown off balance and the dream is somehow some way of rectifying it. I think so that there's a very trivial, common, but still very important way in which we are all traumatized on a nightly basis and working it out creatively, on a daily basis and working it out creatively on a nightly basis. So you could say, then of course, there are the really severe shocks to the system which cannot be just folded into the everyday irritability that is the property of protoplasm itself, but it's something much more profound. And beyond that, there's the cumulative trauma. The cumulative trauma. I feel, frankly, that this past couple of weeks has been one of the great moments in American history. I really do feel that there's been an enormous breakthrough. I'm still profoundly moved hearing the president's speech in Tucson on the radio once through, watching it on television all the way through a second time, both times tears streaming down my eyes and just and face, and just amazed at the power of what I was seeing, the psychological intelligence of the speech that he made, and the sense that this was a very, very important moment. And the whole dreamlike quality of the astronaut in space, that's the brother-in-law, the astronaut that's the husband, the little girl born on 9-1-1, and then to reflect back to what her life has been and how she becomes a kind of living symbol of what it has seemed like to me as if almost the last, those 9 years of her life were a cumulative trauma. Just being in America has been a very painful experience for the last 9 years. And I think that would be true for many people of many different political persuasions. I don't think it's unique to people on the left or people with a, you know, it's easy where one sits politically to see it as the trauma is just to us. But I think it's been a rather, we've had a kind of strange experience. So we're very close to this. Actually, I hear about that political, that's even the word to say it, the injury or the anxiety about the national and world situation has, I'm not alone in knowing this, for so many therapists turned out to be the thing that most patients want to return to most often. It's almost replaced talking about one's parents and what they didn't do right. It's almost as if the state of the world has become the issue. So I think we're very, very close to an understanding of what trauma is in a visceral way, and understanding a certain helplessness we feel and how grateful we are at those moments when something happens that offers a creative opportunity and someone rises to that opportunity, as I think just about everyone would agree Mr. Obama did when he made his amazing speech. So we're also aware that there are many creative solutions to trauma which are more malignant. There's a lot of artistry in terrorism. There's a lot of artistry in demagoguery. There's a lot of creativity in cynicism, and we have a lot of that in our midst too. So I'm no different from the rest of you, even though I'm giving the lecture. I'm a participant observer in a situation I don't completely understand and don't know quite where it's going, but I do have my Jungian trust that it is useful to contemplate the images that emerge and to try to look for patterns. I do find that still, since I first discovered it in my own analysis starting in 1965, I do still feel, 45 years later, that there's nothing more healing than to contemplate the situation and the way the psyche wants to construe it. And it may be all we have. So I'm going to offer some artifacts along that line of a cultural nature with the hope that we can get our imaginations stirring. I think the most destructive thing we all could do is to lose our faith in what Mr. Obama called the moral imagination. I was so happy to hear those words coming from an American president. So this is an attempt to look at the moral imagination and its creativity in the face of intense demoralizing experience. So you can play on the word moral and morale. They have something to do with each other, in my opinion. So let's start with a clip from a film to show set the stage and present to you almost the inevitability of trauma, and perhaps to begin with a Jungian theory of trauma that's very generic, as so much of Jung is. So this isn't going to answer all of your questions, but it might frame it. We could define trauma in Jungian terms as a moment when the shadow tests the soul. You could say it as simply as that. If you want to be more specific, as I am going to be in this clip that I'm going to show you, you could say, because this is the work of a male director, I can say this, this is the moment when the trickster crowds the anima. One could say equally, this is a moment when trickster might crowd the animus, but in this particular film, we're looking at the dance of anima and trickster. Now, the trickster is an archetype I'm very fond of, and maybe that fondness is one way of managing my fear of the archetype, because life is tricky. And life presents the soul with particularly challenging events. And as someone who speaks and performs a lot, it's very close to the bone for me to watch this happen on stage while one is trying to perform. So from a movie I saw first run when I was 15 years old and have never stopped watching since, A Star is Born with Judy Garland and James Mason, I'm going to run the opening sequence of the film, which I think is one of the most beautiful pieces of filmmaking of the great filmmaker George Cukor. And although it was focused at the time as a chance for Judy Garland to stage a major Hollywood comeback after a tough stretch, and she did perform magnificently. It has much more to say about all of us than just about her, but she stands to this day as symbol of someone who knew how to rise to the occasion, knew a lot about trauma, knew how to use it to rise to the occasion. And in some ways, this is my favorite section of her work. So it's going to be a rather long piece because I want to take you through the developing tension as the shadow figure begins to gain power. I don't think I need to introduce the film more than that, because since I'm showing you the opening sequence, the thing should tell its own story. I've allowed subtitles to show just in case someone wants to pick up a piece of dialogue they couldn't quite hear. But I will advise you to not cling to the words. The film is in English, the sound system in the room is pretty good, and I want you to actually experience the movie. So I hope the subtitles will be helpful to follow the story and make it a little easier, but that it won't interfere with your ability to focus on what's happening on the screen, because it's filled with information and filled with the stuff and the warp and woof of what makes trauma such a dramatic experience for all of us. So the whole issue of the drama is here too. So we have and this is a very dreamlike sequence. So we have dream and trauma and drama. Probably drama isn't cognate with the others, but psychologically these are related ideas. And I hope this will set the mood, and then I'm going to go into something a little more discursive, where I'm actually going to read a bit of paper. But let's start with Judy Garland, James Mason, and George Cukor's A Star is Born.
Tonight.
George, how are you? Isn't she adorable?
pleasure of having lovely Lola Lavery here at our microphone.
Did you ever see anyone so sweet, so unspoiled and down to earth? Oh, she's a darling girl.
Thank you.
Hello, Lola.
Hey, darling.
Norma's not here, not a sign of him.
Did you call for him at his house? That was the plan.
He wasn't there. I've been all over town, the usual places. Not a sign of
him. Dearly, Normie loves being late. He's always late with me.
You're not exactly a public performance, my dear. You know where I'm sitting, Louis.
I'll check backstage again. I'll let you know.
Hiya, Norman.
Hello, Matt, boy. Mr. and Mrs. Jai, have you been searching for me?
Oh, that's all right. I knew you'd turn up.
Touching your friends and me, Matt. Touching. Mr. Libby looks after me like a fond mother with a good sense of double-entry bookkeeping. Mr. Libby, I should explain, is in charge of the public relations of the studio. How's the AP and the UP?
Fine. Norman, well, I got some of the boys over.
How many lies have you told the public today?
Oh, a couple hundred, I guess. Look, I need you for an interview with some pictures.
I don't need any more pictures. I don't need any more interviews because the public loves you.
Sure, they do. But just a few, I promise the boys.
Take your hands off me. And don't make any promises with me, but I will break them. A horse! My kingdom for a horse. I'll tell you what, Libby. I'm thirsty. I need a drink before I go. And if you get me a drink, I'll let you take a picture.
That's a deal.
Two drinks, two pictures.
Three drinks, three pictures.
Three pictures. You're not a bad fellow, Libby. Why do you disgust me? Why do I hate you so, Libby?
I wouldn't know about that, Norman.
no more pictures. Get your pencils out, boys.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, no time.
You got plenty of time.
Are you trying to stop me? Are you trying to stop me going on? Is that it?
No.
Spot this, not so hot this. Hey there, shy one, come be my one. Please don't rush off, what no brush off. I can't compel you to buy what I'd sell you, but I'd like to tell you like so. You wanna have bells that'll ring. You wanna have songs that'll sing. You want to style your baby blue. You gotta have me go with you. Hey, you fooled you. Why so cool you? When I'm ready to go steady. You wanna have eyes that'll shine. You wanna have grapes on the vine. You want a love that's truly true. You gotta have me go with you.
You gotta have me.
Why the hold out? Time you woke up, time you spoke up. This line I'm handing you is not a handout. As a team we'd be a stand-up. You wanna live high on a dime. You wanna have two hearts in rhyme. Gotta have me go with you. Why the hold out? Have you sold out?
Time you woke up. Time you spoke up.
With you, why the hold out? Have you sold out? Time you woke up, time you spoke up. This line I'm handing you is not a handout. As a team, we'd be a standout. You want to live high on a dime, you want to have two hearts to cry. Gotta have me.
Repeatedly demonstrated how important the archetype of the persona is. It's the most neglected of the Jungian archetypes. And we couldn't possibly talk about trauma without talking about it as not just an issue for the soul, and of course I'm going to hold on to my notion of Judy Garland as a soul figure at some level, but this is also a persona situation. And what Judy is doing here is trying to maintain the persona of her act. And so we certainly have persona anxiety. Social psychologists have repeatedly demonstrated this, and I think Jungian psychology could learn a great deal from people like Irving Goffman, who wrote a book called The Presentation of Self in Every everyday life. I knew a social psychologist very well who studied so much of the social psychological literature from things like cognitive dissonance and others, and came up with a very simple theory that I still think could be thought about, which he called SIT, S-I-T, Situated Identity Theory. And his theory was basically that in any possible human situation, the most common social behavior is to try to adopt the most favorable identity, socially speaking, that one can find in that situation. And many, many social psychological experiments, for instance, in the South in the 1960s, after the civil rights movement began to have some traction, but long before people had come anywhere near agreeing that integration was the right solution, social psychologists pretending to be Gallup pollsters would interview people, and there would be some other person in the area who was seen answering the questions first. And the person seen answering the questions would always take positions far more liberal than were known to be endemic in the particular area where the Gallup poll was being taken. And just the act of seeing someone else answering the questions in a liberal way, and the pollster writing them down, was enough to tilt the results of the Gallup poll in a very liberal direction, as if people didn't want to be caught saying what wasn't socially acceptable, whereas what they might have said in a situation that makes something else socially acceptable would be very different. This idea that we always behave in such a way as to take on the most favorable identity in the social situation as we can was the heart of this situated identity theory, and it's a wonderful theory of how the persona works, and it's a very good way to think about the power of the persona in shaping just about any possible social behavior. So what we can certainly say is that the soul has a great investment in having as good a persona as possible. And so trauma is precisely that which makes that so much harder. And you could say that trauma is something that makes it much harder to maintain the persona. We say in common speech, I think I'm going to lose it, and the it we're going to lose is that ability to manage the persona. So it's particularly fascinating to watch the creativity with which Judy Garland rises to the occasion. And she was a marvelous improviser, and she was able to credibly improvise this solution to what used to be in the cartoons of H.T. Webster called life's darkest moment. I can't think of a worse thing than to have someone come on stage like that in the middle of your act. And we also, of course, watch the press agent who's concerned specifically with maintaining the persona of the actor, having to maintain his persona in the provocations of Norman Maine and the shaming and the psychological and physical abuse that he's dishing out. He has to somehow maintain a poise, and so it's kind of a lovely. What I like about the clip as a whole is that it so beautifully creates for us all to experience and feel the problem of anxiety, that mounting anxiety that we will not be able to maintain the persona. We know the show must go on, but in this case we don't want that particular show to go on. And it's a wonderful tension, and all of the people on the stage are cooperating in creating a system of anxiety. And so that's almost saying all the parts of the self get into the problem. of holding it together, whatever that it is. So it's really not just persona in the usual way we think of persona as something shallow, but it's the whole self-organization of can we make this thing fly, play, so forth. So the creative solution of being able to somehow rise to the occasion, somehow improvise, somehow make it work out, somehow integrate the shadow into the act in such a way that it's a win-win is sort of the ideal we all have. We all have that hope. So in a certain sense, this is probably the creativity of everyday life. I think one of the charms of Judy Garland is that she, of course, she's being... I remember seeing the movie with my mother, and Lola Lavery came on. My mother whispered in my ear, they're building her up. They're going to show this affected woman, so we'll show how natural Judy Garland is. And, of course, it works. But one of her things was that she was so homemade. She was so real on screen. So she becomes a kind of every woman who stands for everyday life and the vicissitudes of everyday life, where we have to come up with that kind of creativity more frequently than we think. I mean, a scene, an ugly scene, is always just about to threaten, and all of us have to manage it in some way. And a little bit of it is like the producer, a little bit of us is like the publicity man, a little bit of it is like the other actors on the stage. A lot of it is like Judy Garland. And unfortunately, some of it is like Norman Maine. There's also a part of all of us that wants to tear it, that is asserting itself at the wrong time and in the wrong way and feels entitled and is demonic and is a trickster and is everything wrong. That's part of us too. So we have this drama on a regular basis. And it's a creative struggle. It's an aesthetic struggle. It's an effort to make something harmonize in a situation of some complexity. Our complexes make us complex people, yet we have this ambition. So I want to kind of frame what I'm going to talk about in that way. And now move into what I told the psychoanalysts in Rio de Janeiro, trying to help them realize that Jungians are not just another pretty face, but that we understand some of the same things they do, that they're not the real deal. I'm not going to give them that. So this is both integrative and combative writing at the same time. I'm not sure which archetypes are involved, but trickster's here too. So here's the statement. It takes about 20 minutes to read. But fortunately, it's broken up with some visual material for you to contemplate on, this time in the form of painting. Trauma and psychic creativity. As is well recognized, the psyche makes every attempt to dissociate itself from traumatic injury by creating its own world, a world where the trauma can no longer have purchase on the soul because the traumatogenic agent's currency is not recognized there. The creativity involved in such a strategy is clearly revealed in Jung's clinical account of a young woman who lived on the moon. She was brought to him in the first years of his private practice when he had quit the Bergholtzli Psychiatric Hospital and was first using psychoanalytic methods in the psychiatric treatment of seriously disturbed patients. He described this patient to colleagues at several points in his career, first in several letters to Freud in 1910 and 1911, later to his most brilliant student, Marie-Louise von Franz, when she was first learning about analytical psychology in the 1930s, much later in a lecture on schizophrenia that was read at the Second International Congress for Psychiatry in 1957, organized by Manfred Bleuler, the son of his old chief at the Bergholzli. And finally, as part of the reminiscences, he confided to Anneli Jaffe in the last years of his life, which became his posthumously published Memories, Dreams, Reflections. My colleague Donald Kalshid has reviewed this case in his book, The Inner World of Trauma, where he cites the lady who lived on the moon as an example of what he calls archetypal defenses of the personal spirit. I think most of you will know that book from 1996. And I would like to begin my remarks today by recalling this case to you because it is an example of a patient's psychic creativity in the aftermath of trauma, a type of archetypal creativity you might expect a Jungian analyst to know something about. In his paper on schizophrenia, written in 1957, Jung gives a psychiatric account of the patient's problem. He says the patient had been hospitalized for catatonia and hallucinations at age 17, and that she was still in a catatonic condition when she was brought to him 2 years later by her brother, who was also a doctor. This physician had turned to Jung in desperation, giving him carte blanche on his sister's behalf to undertake anything humanly possible, even a psychoanalytic treatment that might carry the risk of suicide. Jung told his psychiatric colleagues that when the 19-year-old patient arrived in his office, she was, this is Jung speaking, completely mutistic. Her hands were cold and bluish. She had livid patches on her face and dilated, feebly reacting pupils. I lodged her in a sanitarium nearby, and from there on she was brought to me every day for an hour's consultation. After weeks of effort, I succeeded, by dint of constantly repeated questions, in getting her to whisper a few words at the end of every session. The moment she started to speak, her pupils contracted, the livid patches on her face disappeared. Soon her hands grew warm and assumed their normal color. Finally, she began, with endless blockings at first, to talk and to tell me the content of her psychosis. She had only a fragmentary education, had grown up in a small town in a bourgeois milieu, and had no trace of mythological and folkloristic knowledge. She now related to me a long and elaborate myth, a description of her life on the moon, where she played the role of a female savior for the moon people. The classical connection of the moon with lunacy was as unknown to her as the numerous other mythological motifs in her story. The first relapse occurred after about 4 months of treatment was caused by the sudden realization that she could no longer go back to the moon after betraying her secret to a human being. She fell into a state of violent excitement which necessitated her transfer to a psychiatric clinic. Professor Eugen Bleuler, my former chief, confirmed the diagnosis of catatonia. After about 2 months, the acute interval abated and the patient could be moved back to the sanitarium and resume treatment. She was now rather more accessible and began to discuss problems that are characteristic of cases of neurosis. Her former apathy and lack of affect gradually gave way to a somewhat lymphatic emotionality and soulfulness. Unavoidably, the problem of her reentry into normal life and her acceptance of a social existence became more and more pressing. When she found herself confronted with this unavoidable task, a second relapse ensued, and again she had to be put in the clinic with a severe attack of delirium. This time, the clinical diagnosis was unusual epileptoid twilight state with a question mark. Evidently, her emotional life, reawakened in the interval, had blurred the schizophrenic traits. Despite my qualms, I was able to discharge the patient after rather more than a year's treatment as cured. For more than 30 years, she kept me informed by letter about the state of her health. A few years after her cure, she married and had children, and she assured me she never had any more pathological attacks. In other places, Jung goes into more detail about the fantasies this woman was having about being a savior to the moon people, including how she herself got captured by the daimon that she was attempting to save them from. I must refer you to Kalshed's book for an adequate treatment of the clinical transference problem of dealing with daimonic defenses that isolate people who are already inflated and identified with archetypal contents. Here, I only want to note that these three I dangers, inflation, identification, and isolation, have been recorded in the Jungian literature for over 50 years now, the first being Henderson, 1954, as the risks to the mental health of anyone who traffics too much with the collective unconscious in the attempt to gain power over humiliating trauma. Obviously, I wrote that in case they thought we didn't know that. As Jung was to discover when he finally succeeded in getting his patient to return to the earth, she had fled, and talk about the problem that had driven her to seek solace elsewhere. She had been sexually abused by the brother who had brought her to treatment. The shadow cast by the fact that she was not facing that reality when she turned to fantasy, and that for a time she lost her sanity in the process of creating an alternate symbolic reality to deal with her conflict, does not obscure the creativity of the archetypal solution. Her psychosis displays the mythopoetic ingenuity that Jung was the first analyst fully to appreciate. I will follow in the tradition he inaugurated by pointing out that the moon, in classical mythology, was the planetary instantiation of Artemis, sister of Apollo the sun. She was a fierce protectress of her own virginity and that of her companion nymphs. The story of the hunter Actaeon, who stumbled onto a clearing in the woods where she was bathing with her nymphs and had the misfortune to have the goddess see him, seeing her naked, is one of the most popular of the ancient world's myths, and it has inspired many a painting since the Renaissance, the most famous being Titian's rendering of the scene. Artemis turned Actaeon into a stag, and he was hunted down and killed by the goddess's hounds. The creative strategy of Jung's patience turned to fantasy soon becomes evident if we consider this cultural mythological background. As a moon goddess, she was certainly likely to be safe from any further sexual abuse. One famous feature of Jung's cure of this young woman was that he accepted her statement that she was living on the moon at face value. When first learning analytical psychology, his student von Franz actually became indignant at hearing him describe this patient as if she had really been on the moon and it had happened. But she imagined herself to be on the moon, or she dreamt it, but she wasn't on the moon, she said to Jung. But Jung stood firm in his way of putting the matter. Yes, she was on the moon. It took the young von Franz several days to realize what that meant, that the psyche is real. Of course, we know that from the movie Matter of Heart, where she says this in the interviews. Only when she grasped that she could appreciate just, only when she grasped that could von Franz appreciate just how ingenious and demonic the patient's psychotic solution was. In other words, the lunacy had a point. From the standpoint of the psyche, the young woman had succeeded in fully replacing one reality with another and had to accept the full consequence, a lunar life quite as peopled with dangerous others as her earthly existence had been. Today, none of this sounds very daring. I think most of us expect Jungian analysts to understand the way intuitive, archetypal fantasy becomes reality for some patients, and assume that a Jungian clinician will have a way of talking to patients like that about their experiences. Readers of the professional literature have also noticed that Jungian clinicians have become quite shrewd at recognizing when a symbolic solution is functioning not only as an elaborate, successful exercise in denial, but also as a dangerous refusal to accept the energies of life. My favorite quoted statement of Jung of all is something he's supposed to have said at one time to someone in Zurich. Every damn fool dreams. Jungians today know just as well as Freudians that these healing energies can only be released when conflicts are confronted head on with integrity. That is, if patient and analyst stay open and accountable to all emotions in the process, whatever symbolic solutions emerge. So again, I'm telling them that we know that you don't just beam when someone defends themselves with archetypal imagery. I mean, you see whether it's working for them and making something happen or whether it's a barrier preventing a connection to reality. So the turn to fantasy is one way in which psychic creativity is able to tap the symbolizing capacity of mind in the course of healing. There is, however, another complementary way, that's complementary as in C-O-M-P-L-E-M-E-N-T-A-R-Y, complementary way, in which psychic creativity frequently asserts itself in the wake of trauma, one that I recognize just as much in my analytic practice, and this I would call the turn to realism. Realism, in the way I am using it here, is a term in the history of the arts where it is sometimes treated as if the presentation of the real in a painting or a novel were an alternative to fantasy rather than another form of fantasizing. Thanks, however, to some very fine historical and critical work by such luminaries in the academic fields of art history and literary criticism as Linda Nochlin, Michael Fried, T.J. Clark, and Peter Brooks, all of them working in American universities, who came to their points of view about realism in the deconstructive decades since 1960, we are able to see realism in a very different light than when Gustave Courbet first found himself hailed by both hostile and friendly critics in 19th century France as the founder and prime exemplar of the new school of realism. Courbet was a contemporary of Balzac. Balzac was doing it in literature. Courbet was doing it in art. And the term realism was first applied in relation to Courbet's art. It was a big breakthrough in French art, really a generation before, if you call a generation 25 years, say, a generation before the Impressionists. And he was, some people speak of Courbet even today as the first really modern artist. He was the first artist to have a show of many of his paintings while he was alive. In other words, he had the first one-man show. He's a very interesting figure, and I've followed his work since I wrote this paper with great pleasure. There have been a lot of shows of Courbet in the last 10 years. Courbet's realism, the painter quickly adopted the term to shame his many enemies in the art world, only to be taken to task by contemporaries like Baudelaire for the pretensions of the term, was, as Clark particularly has understood, a strategy of shock adopted by this very public painter in the course of changing times to deal with the trauma of political upheaval. As Brooks says of the art historical movement known as realism, its advent in France surely has much to do with the Revolution of 1848, which overthrew the bourgeois monarchy of Louis-Philippe and led to a brief period of a progressive republic, extinguished by Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte in his coup d'etat of 2 December 1851. Then the declaration of the Second Empire a year later, with this new Bonaparte become Emperor Napoleon III. imagine only these people who've lived in America since the 2000 election can know in contemporary times how incredibly disappointed the French liberals were when suddenly they found themselves with a new empire and a new imperialist right-wing government headed by a Bonaparte after all they'd been through and all they'd hoped to attain in the way of a democracy and the famous liberal revolutions of 1848, how quickly the political tide turned in a way that was as disappointing to them as some of the things that have happened in this country have been disappointing to some of us. Courbet is a perfect example of how the cumulative trauma of these successive waves of government, jostling hopes that were finally dashed on the rocks of political reality, produced a counter-realistic response. That is to say, he countered an increasingly oppressive political reality with the strategy of realism. Now, he already had realism in his art, but he really used it now to fight back. So I'd like to show you just one of his paintings, and this is going to be The Bathers, the second of the slides, which is in Montpellier in the south of France. No, that's the way they were painting before Courbet came on the scene. That's an idealized image of Courbet by a salon painter. Now we're going to see Courbet's image from The Bathers of 1853 will be the second one. That's it. Now, yeah, we're going to show it first here, and then we're going to show a somewhat larger image of it, which we have in the computer. But let me just say a little bit about it. This is a painting so passive-aggressive that Napoleon III himself was said to have struck it with a riding whip when it was first exhibited at the Salon in Paris. The central, and some would say two central figures, a woman, because of the outsized nature of the painting, a gargantuan woman emerging from bathing in a stream. Her feet are muddy, and her buttocks are both fat and enormous. More disconcerting still is the fact that one can see a pattern over them that looks anatomically like the lower sacrum and coccyx, creating a visible shadow of the body on the surface of her skin. That comes clearer when we show the computer image. Are we showing that now? Yeah. You can really see, you just don't get that much image looking at most backs. I've stood in front of this painting several times, and it is hard to do so without experiencing the nauseating sensation of being witness to something vestigial. It's a very strange effect. I don't know if you've ever bought a snapper or something to cook for dinner, and you're starting to eat it, and you look down, and you see a bit of its skin, and you suddenly are aware you're eating a reptile. And so there's something very upsetting about that vestigial feeling. It's a very, and at the time, when we were still in that patriarchal French time, used to, and now we could show the other slide, the very idealized image of gods and goddesses and mythological subjects like Achilles were much more to the point, the naked Achilles, where the body is absolutely perfect, and in this case also male, to emphasize the patriarchal attitude with this. It's hard perhaps now to realize how shocking what Courbet had done was. But as Courbet wrote in a letter just after the painting was put on exhibition for the first time, it appalls a little. Part of the upset may come not just from our reaction to the large body's uncanny evocation of past physical forms, and each passing year I have a lot more empathy for that large body, but also from our revulsion at the reaction of the other woman in the painting. Now we should go back to the Courbet, perhaps either one of the images would be fine, who seems to be the naked bather's servant. I actually got a student in art history to help me look at this painting, because it's not an easy image to read, and I think I got the best reading this painting has ever had, because no one has been able to quite decipher what is happening. But it looks as if the servant has been sitting on her mistress's fine clothes and is embarrassed to be surprised in the activity of appropriating them for her own uses. So she accepts with grateful but also sycophantic veneration the ambiguously reassuring gesture of her aristocratically earringed mistress, who holds out a dismissive hand as if to say that this is all right. Now, this is political allegory. This is something about how the return of the empire and the pretensions of the empire are somehow very exciting to the French people in some way, and there's a kind of unpleasant and disgusting process taking place in the body politic. As Courbet said in a letter written a year later to his patron, Alfred Brouillard, who had commented on this painting's inopportune and afflicting truth, the painting represents, this is Courbet talking, a curious phase in my life, namely irony. This satiric outside portrait of a powerful body reasserting itself is almost surely an allegory of the return of imperial aristocratic government to France, an archaic political form, obscenely welcomed by a bourgeois population, the overawed servant, all too ready to give back the prerogatives it had won in 1848. The ironic perspective of the ambiguous painting suggests Courbet's own acute consciousness of his own place in history. In one of his letters, he compares his attitude at the time he painted it to a published photograph of himself taken around the same time, which he thought depicted accurately a man who succeeds in spite of wind and tide. This really made a lot of sense to me when I wrote this in 2005, 5 years into those 9 years since... or 4 years since 2001, 5 years since 2000, this decade of cumulative trauma that we've been through, that I could really see how much I had taken on a certain bitter, sarcastic attitude in myself. Courbet's is an attitude and a response that I find typical of a certain kind of creativity in the face of trauma. The realistic manner, wherever it is found, is ironic in that it offers itself to a world that the one adopting such a manner regards as transfixed by illusions. In other words, we taking the realistic manner are the people who think we're the only people who are not deluded. Analysts will recognize Courbet's manner of expression, including what he called his real allegories, in any patient who defiantly insists on using analytic hours to discuss in tedious detail just everyday realities, often presented in a vengeful way to the analyst, as if to someone living in a comfortable ivory tower, not aware of what is really going on in the world. The fantasy stance behind the patient's manner in such instances seems to be of a radical turning away from idealism to a more unflinching contemplation of the real. In other words, the patient is saying, only I look at the real. You live in a world of dreams and fantasies. It is tempting to see this as only an expression of the bitterness and cynicism that the disillusion that accompanies trauma can bring in its wake. Trauma, as Neville Symington has recently put it, is an experience that breaks the spirit. That is probably the most serious and important definition of trauma that I know. It comes from his book, A Pattern of Madness, from 2002, which I recommend to all of you. Very fine book. The Jungian analyst, Barbara Sullivan, called my attention to it. I'm extremely grateful that she did. Trauma is an experience that breaks the spirit. And how better to convey the vengeful mood of the post-traumatic psyche than to suggest that the spirit of idealism is dead, drowned in the ugly reality of the real. And of course, that was why Obama's speech caused so much many tears. It was beyond anything beyond the. It was more the tears of amazement and relief at the potential for healing, as if. And the return of a spirit of idealism that one, it wasn't drowned in the ugly reality of the real, but the vengeful mood says that it is. And of course, that's what we need to worry about. Now, when this happens clinically, I have found it more advantageous than exposing the bitterness of the patient. In other words, just saying to someone how cynical you are, how bitter you are, is not necessarily a healing intervention. I found it more advantageous to join in with the discussion of the real, so that the stance of realism is humanized in a dialogue that seeks not just vengefully to assert, but actually to construe reality. With severely traumatized patients, not just those who've been traumatized by psychiatric interventions such as hospitalizations that have left them questioning the uses of authority in the world, I have often joined in a discussion of political realities, elections, current events, statements by political and religious leaders. The point of the discussion is to see what's really there in the world of power. I have found traumatized patients to be shrewd appraisers of that, and I've learned much from them in our dialogues. Now, I thought I was telling the psychoanalyst something, but the Brazilian psychoanalyst who was on the same panel with me gave a paper which just blew me away, because he described a particular work with a patient he was seeing five times a week on the couch, and she arrived on one particular day to her analytic hour, and the usual ritual was that he stood up, she entered the room, he waited until she assumed her position on the couch, then he sat down and the analysis proper began. On this day, she came in and said, have you heard? Have you heard? And he looks at her and says, what? And he wonders if she slipped into a psychotic state. And she starts talking about a bombing in New York. Since the day is September 11th, 2001, he begins to realize that she may be talking about an actual attack on New York, in which case World War III is about to begin, and he's wondering what he should do. Should he call his family? So still standing, he and his patient spend the entire analytic hour, never getting to the couch, just standing in mutual terror, talking about what might happen if the attack is real. It's an absolutely incredible presentation of what I consider a perfect moment in analysis, where the analyst accepts that the real is valid. Very, very interesting moment. So, I have found it important when real things are going on to talk about them in as much as possible in a real way, and to try to construe reality with my patient, and I find that that is very useful. In fact, I have found traumatized patients to be extremely shrewd appraisers of what's really going on in the world of power, and I've learned much from them in our dialogues. It's amazing what they see and what they feel and how right on it can be. And it is of great importance to the patient to have me care about this activity of testing power realities, which eventually brings them to start to figure out what is going on in the ways they deploy their own power. And I would particularly point out how important this is to patients who have a strong amount of introverted feeling or whose introverted feeling has been aroused by certain events in their lives, because introverted feeling, it's not enough said, frequently tracks the way power is used. And when that issue is addressed, a lot of good things can happen. Actually, Alfred Adler knew this. And he may have been introverted feeling himself, but he brought that in. And Jung didn't leave it out, but I found as a technique, I've had to find my own way to just talk about what's really happening and also how decisions are being made that are impacting people at a feeling level. And often these are collective decisions, and these have been useful dialogues. There are also moments when the turn to the real can only be described as sublime. And now I'm quoting the work of the feminist psychoanalyst Kristeva. Recently, a turn to the real in the face of trauma can involve something sublime, Recently, and this is recently at the time of my writing of this paper in 2005, a former Jungian analysand in her 70s, one of many in the extended Jungian community who go to conferences that center on mythological topics, a woman both fond and knowledgeable of the literature on feminine mysteries, found herself in one. She was going to the hospital for a surgical incision of a malignant lump in her breast. This was her third brush with cancer, and as she found herself on the eve of an operation, it came to her, lying in her hospital bed, that the hospital was like an ancient temple. The doctors were the priests, and the other people working around them were like the slaves. The image was compelling, and it helped her to get to sleep. So this is a creative use of fantasy that's not so different from that of the lady who lived on the moon, although its replacement of reality is much more adaptive in context, but it did get the patient to sleep. I probably should say this is an introverted, intuitive woman, and so that kind of archetypal image both seemed to be real to her and at the same time consoling. Well, the next morning she was taken to have a mammogram prior to the lumpectomy. Now, a mammogram prior to a lumpectomy is not the nicest experience. A wire had to be inserted with the aid of the mammogram so that the surgeon would know exactly where to excise the tumor. Her breast was anesthetized, but she could feel the pressure on her breast in the mammography machine. Doctors and X-ray technicians kept coming into and going out of the room explaining, "We have to take this picture and look at it and be sure we're in the right place." This happened two or three times while the patient sat there, her breast wedged in the mammography machine, becoming increasingly uneasy. Then the image from the previous night came to her, and she thought, well, this is a temple, and this is part of an initiation taking place. What she was having to endure was an initiatory ordeal. The patient thought of different people she might call upon in her mind to support her through it. It was then that someone she hadn't thought of in years popped into her mind, a senior analyst's wife who was notable in the community of Jungians for her extreme down-to-earth manner and presence. She could have been the wife of a farmer, and I actually sometimes thought of her hardworking analyst husband as if he also was a farmer. She had very flat feet, and she was just extremely real. She's very real. This woman had the ability to meet every situation matter-of-factly. She had herself faced cancer and her husband's death and meeting these challenges to her very presence, simply and realistically. They were just reality. This very real and realistic woman, certainly not a great goddess or archetypal image of the transcendent feminine, not even an analyst, but an analyst's wife, was who came in fantasy to the rescue of the former Jungian patient in the mammography machine. And I would call this figure emerging out of her memory an image of realism, a form of fantasy that when it spontaneously appears to a psyche coping with trauma, can be one of its most creative and potent healers. So that was the paper that I read to the psychoanalyst. We can maybe turn the lights on for a minute. And that got me through the 20 minutes on the panel and enabled me to have a wonderful, almost a fantasy experience in Brazil. It was an absolutely wonderful time. But I did feel, when I came home, that something was incomplete, that I just hadn't gotten to my stuff. I hadn't gotten to what I do or what it turned. How do I solve trauma? What do I do? What is the part that I'm interested in? This was all true. This was valid. It was empathic. It saw what other people were doing. But somehow, I hadn't gotten to me or to my own real feelings in the matter. So you could say that I was at the stage of the first clip from A Star Is Born, where the sort of the trauma of having to speak to the Freudians at all was somehow managed by, I got the persona, created the paper, and it's a good paper for that purpose. Sort of like what Judy did, she somehow manages to do it, but we're never satisfied when our solutions to trauma simply happen at the persona level. When we can sort of hold our head up again, that's okay. But it doesn't make us, it doesn't really, all you can do is breathe a sigh of relief that, like Kevin and I wrote a paper that would pass muster and I get off stage. But found interesting things. But something else can happen, and that is what I would call moral creativity. And since I wrote a book on integrity, I'm very interested in what Mr. Obama was calling, as I said, the moral imagination and the possibility of moral creativity. And that is something spiritual and ethical at the same time, and it moves us down to something much deeper than persona and much closer to self. And so what I want to do now is try to show you a second clip from A Star Is Born that comes later in the film. So we're going to be on side two, and we're going to be at scene 41 in a second. And I think you, if you've seen the film, you know what happens. It's a sort of a fairy tale of show business. Because she rescues him on stage at the Night of Stars, Norman Maine is both grateful and curious as to who this woman is, so he sort of makes an effort to find her after he sobers up that night and actually finds her singing with her band at a little club just for themselves, and has the amazing experience of watching Judy Garland sing The Man That Got Away, and gets her a screen test, and sure enough, she becomes a big star, and as her star rises, his star is going down, and they marry, and he's fighting his alcoholism but not winning the battle. And this is the scene that when I saw it with my mother, said, this could never happen. This could never happen. And yet, as I've watched it over the years many times, it has just an eerie credibility to it at the level of soul, self, moral creativity. I think it's one of the most amazing scenes in all film. And this is the scene at which the now reborn, renamed Vicki Lester is being given her chance to win an Academy Award because she's been nominated and she's expected to win because her performance has captured the imagination of the country. So we are at something we all seem to watch, that Academy Awards ceremony. So let's look at, see if we can get to scene 41 of A Star Is Born.
Disappointed. And then the pride of the household said, Daddy, why is it called an Oscar? Shut up, I explained. And then my dear wife entered the argument with a little lecture on child psychology. And it's rather lucky that I'm here at all tonight.
You don't think anything's happened to him, do you?
You know what the traffic's like.
I wish I could have explained to him. Well, I wish I could have made him understand that many of us feel that to win one of them is ample reward for an entire career. I know I do. Thank you.
Present this year's award for the best actress.
Stop worrying. Think how nice that statuette's gonna look on your mantelpiece.
Last year's Academy Award winner, Mr. Nigel Peters.
Those nominated for the best performance by an actress are Jane Brandon, Those Who Seek, Vicki Lester, A World for Two, Alice Tenney, The Great Chance, Shirley Vander, Don't Cry My Love. The winner is Miss Vicki Lester.
Something like this happens to you, and I'm not going to lie to you and tell you I didn't keep hoping it would happen. All the speeches that you've made up in your bedroom or in the bathtub go out of your mind completely, and you find that out of all the words in the world, just two stick in your mind. Thank you. And all I can do is to say them to you from my heart.
Congratulations, my dear. I made it just in time to know. May I borrow the end of your speech to make a speech of my own? My method for gaining your attention may seem a little unconventional, but hard times call for harsh measures. I had my speech all prepared, but I... gone right out of my head. You seem... Why, it's silly to be so formal, isn't it? I know most of you sitting out there by your first names, don't I? I made a lot of money for you, gentlemen, in my time, through the years, haven't I? Well, I need a job now. Yeah, that's it. That's the speech. That's it. I need a job. That's what I wanted to say. I need a job. It's as simple as that. I need a job. That's all. My talents, I may say, are not confined to dramatic parts. I can play comedy too. Yes. Well, play something, somebody.
Norman,
sequence that you may forget to do what I asked you to do at the beginning of the lecture, to also contemplate what you're seeing. Because, of course, this takes what was shown to us in the first scene to the absolute limit, and now we are in the true moment of trauma. Freud originally felt that trauma doesn't actually happen until it comes around a second time. Because the first time it happens, you're so stunned. We usually talk about it as the baby is too little or its perceptual apparatus, but I think that probably insults the intelligence of babies. Let's just say the first time around, at whatever age, we hardly know what's hitting us, so we cope as best we can, just as Judy did in the first version. But the second time, because we can now use the first as a reference, the horror is that we are completely aware of what's going on. You see, so it may be a later event, it's often said, to trigger the full trauma response. This is all through the trauma literature, that someone might see an auto accident and suddenly remember the explosion of a time in war when someone saw someone blown up and nobody dealt with it. Just nobody dealt with it. And again, if you don't put this back on babies, but realize that all of us are a baby in trauma the first time around, this time, of course, it's the real deal. I mean, it's one thing when you're a band singer with a small act. It's another to have that moment, which seems to come to most actresses once and not very often twice, when they win the Academy Award. That's not the moment when you want your drunken husband to come on stage. I mean, even Sandra Bullock's husband had the decency to wait until 2 days after she got the Academy Award to humiliate her totally. I mean, in other words, it continues to happen, but not quite this dramatically. So this is the limit. Now, she's a wonderful actress, so all the emotions are there on the stage. Her pity for him, her humiliation, and in one unforgettable, it must only last about 2 seconds, but it's perfectly obvious in her eyes, her absolute fury at what he's doing. I mean, it just shows for just a minute. Now, as he moves around the stage, we begin to see the archetypal quality of what we're looking at in this strange, surreal, and very effective scene. You notice the way he keeps going back and forth and retracing his steps? These are the classic movements of Hermes. And Hermes, of course, is the trickster god. And, of course, Hermes always goes to the boundary and often transgresses the boundary. So this is... And also, Hermes is the god of what that word that so Jungians are so fond of, liminality. Limen, L-I-M-E-N, means the threshold, and liminality is what happens when suddenly you're in no man's land, you're in a new world. Once one of these speeches is overcome, and it's almost as if the people running the show don't know what to do, so time just stops, this couple goes into a completely liminal place in front of everybody. And so for a while, we don't know what's going to happen. And this time, you are quite sure there's no possibility of rescue. This can't be saved like the first time. And it's all out there for all to see. I mean, they have bought up his contract. They tried to keep his alcoholism from becoming something the public could see. But now there's no way that anyone can hide it. So he moves back and forth in his tricksterish way. And she just stands there in that amazing violet-blue dress, almost looking like what? Like the Statue of Liberty holding the Academy Award? Like Guan Yin, the Virgin Mary? What does she look like? That color, the stance? There are only two moments like that in all movies that I know where the actress doesn't move and the effect is overpowering. The other is very famous. It's the end of Queen Christina, when Garbo just looks and becomes a kind of living masthead of the ship that's taking her away. So her immobility during that period turns her into some kind of goddess at that point. I mean, she stops being just a woman winning the Academy Award and something very, very different. So then the question becomes utterly different. The stakes go into some other territory altogether. We're now not at the level of the persona. We're now in an archetypal world. What is the goddess going to do? Is she going to be Artemis throwing Actaeon to the hounds? I mean, what is the goddess going to do? She certainly has the power with that Oscar in her hand. She has all the power of Zeus himself. I mean, she could send her own thunderbolt his way. We don't know what she's going to do. And what she decides to do is so astonishing, and this is what I mean by moral creativity. She decides to be as human as possible and to forget about the audience and just care about him, their marriage, and their intimacy. And suddenly, in front of, and this has been said by others writing about this film, so it's not original with me, but it's certainly true. Suddenly, in front of everyone, they have an amazingly private moment. It's all very easy to say, well, this is the alcoholic wife, or this is codependency, or this isn't a good idea, and so forth. But I don't think that convinces us dramatically. This is, after all, melodrama, and we're seeing something dramatized, and we have to just accept that the most unexpected thing that could happen is that she would become as human, as tender, and as compassionate as possible. And at that point, Norman Maine's work is complete. The star is born. She's an image of the self, not just an actress getting an Academy Award, a flavor of the year, like the persona actor who before her, but suddenly a star for the ages, someone really in the firmament. In other words, the miracle is the self in its in. And you see why Jung used the word self and not other and not God or something, because he implied that it was a stage of being human, but that isn't the ego. In other words, it's very like Buddhism. It's that higher octave of the human that can be achieved when we simply accept our empathic instincts to the full. Very amazing, amazing moment. And I would call that moral creativity. I feel that's a moral gesture. When she made some kind of conscious choice in that direction rather than the direction of simply restoring, defending, insisting upon the persona. And that, to me, is the opportunity that trauma gives us all. So thank you. We have a little time for questions, I think, or anything you want to say. Yes.
So was there a moment, I've never seen the whole film altogether.
Yes.
Is there a moment where he is reaching for the statue and she is holding on to it and she does not let it go?
Perhaps. I've never read the image that way, but I don't think it's impossible. He's certainly taking the moment away from her, so why wouldn't he take the statue? But I didn't see it. I think that may be a reading that you're making, but the only way I can know is to contemplate one more time. Each of us sees a different thing. We always have to check whether we're projecting. I didn't ever read it that way, but I do read him. I read him as testing her to the full, but I see him as finally initiating her rather than robbing her. Although I think this becomes an unconscious process. She is clearly an anima figure in this film, in my opinion. I mean, and the choice to connect is very much an anima choice, rather than a choice to rebuke, which might be another choice that she could have made. It has its place too. For instance, in The Color Purple, we see a scene where the actress rebukes the family, but that's also a moment of self. So I don't want to make the self as only being compassionate. The self can also be fiery and denunciatory if it must be. what we're looking at is something like what's called fixation in alchemy, where something gets very real and is fixed into place. And it involves an integration of the shadow. At this moment, the trickster is presenting itself to the anima and being integrated by her so that she becomes more whole. As she gets him down from the stage and accepts that he's going to need a drink, she's basically also realizing in her own way that he will drink himself to death and he will go off her stage eventually in that way, even though, again, this is happening at deep levels of psyche, so this is not precognition, although that's exactly what happens in the rest of the film. But it's as if she is going to be as human as possible, and what he does is what he does. And there's a ruthlessness in it too. In other words, she's not just a victim anymore. She's integrated some of that trickster into herself. That's what I believe is needed to survive midlife, that we have in midlife to somehow integrate the trickster. We cannot simply be naive and sincere only. There has to be a shadow that is strong enough to survive the shadow of others. And you can see that in this too. It doesn't undo her compassion, but it's there. So what you said is there, which I'm not sure, she is holding on to what's hers. And you've got that right. And you've got that right. She will hold her position. And she secures it in the hearts of all the people watching her in that audience. It's just like the people in the first part watching what he's going to do. Now they're watching what she's going to do. And she having this man is a little bit like him being drunk. Is she going to be able to survive having this situation in her life? And the answer is she is equal to it. She is, and that's where I think moral creativity cannot sometimes change the circumstance, but it can transmute it because we're equal to it. And we don't lose our humanity in the face of it. So it's a very subtle. That's why I'm showing it in film, because it's almost impossible to describe. And even now I'm just reaching for words for what we've actually seen. But that's certainly what I feel as an analyst. When I see someone able to do that with the situations that life presents to them, that is really something. And I feel that's something like the development that you see in the great spiritual figures. It's a true mystery. But it happens. I see it happening all the time. And I honestly felt something like that happen with Mr. Obama the other day. I just felt like it would be. Who would have expected that one could make a presidential visit at a time of mourning into a rally, and that people could accept that and not see it as terribly poor taste? It wasn't. It was an exquisite taste, but it was certainly an unexpected reversal. And again, I think that's part of the hallmark of moral creativity, that it can turn a situation around. It's what makes the I Ching so extraordinary, those of you who use it, that you can feel a certain way, but if you have the humility to consult the I Ching, you will find the situation transformed, because it offers you the possibility of an ethical intervention in what seems like an impossible situation. You take that strategy and the situation is transformed. And this is being dramatized in a human life here. Yes. Well, you know, it can take a lesser, you know, trauma, it's the other way around with trauma. Sometimes the first event is the worst and the second is more minor. I mean, you could say that the Tucson shooting was much smaller in scale. I certainly don't count in these things, but it enabled us to achieve the human response we couldn't achieve. I mean, when George Bush said, "I'm angry," that first day after 9/11, he opened the door to a lot of anger that got acted out in very unconscious ways. When Obama said, "I can find value in this," it offered a completely other possibility. It's almost as if the second time around we had a chance to, well, what do you do when something really awful, destructive, and nasty happens? And is the solution to retaliate, or is there another solution? The word moral imagination was not in his speech for no reason. We're all human. Both are real. Both are valid. I mean, I understand President Bush saying he was angry. It's certainly sincere. I mean, I understand that. But in a way, he didn't know what had hit him. I mean, we saw him trying to think and put it together. He didn't know what had hit him. I mean, people say it's all part of a failed conspiracy and this and that. Maybe history will reveal that. That's not how I read the imagery. I read the imagery as someone who didn't know what it then unconsciously began to lash out. I see someone who this time absolutely knew what it hit. But that's the second time around. The second time around, you get that opportunity. And that's when the moral creativity becomes an option. I mean, I don't think it would have been that different whoever had been president the first time around. I mean, that's something like it. And as nations go, we didn't do as badly as some have done under similar provocation. It was just, so it's not a question of blame here. But it's a question of what people are like when they're hit with something they don't understand, and people are like when they have a chance to meet it in the moment, and this time it's come around again, and they do understand it, and all the feelings come. What is one going to do then? And that's where the chance to be ethical is offered. It's still available, and it's always breathtaking when that choice is made. Right. You see her.
That's one thing. Second is the idea of the birth of the star in a literal sense.
Yes. Yes.
The mass is always the same in the universe.
Right.
For a nova to be coming to fruition, some other mass has to come in.
Oh, that's wonderful. I hadn't realized that, but it's true. Of course you're right. Now that I hear it that way, I realize it's not like a crossword puzzle where you don't think you know the answer till you know the answer, and now you're telling me it. I see. Right. At some point, the shadow either has its way with us or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, that's because something larger absorbs it but goes beyond it to some. So it's not just a chain of evil where one shadow produces another. I mean, she certainly has integrated some shadow. You can see that the way she sits down and is actually relieved that he's going to have a drink, you know, so you can sort of see that piece of the healthy meanness, you could say. But there's much more going on than that. She has chosen to be whole and to be deeply human and feminine and alive as in that way. It's very, very exciting. Well, let's not spoil it. Let's think about it. And maybe you'll come tomorrow. Some of you who have the time, I'd love to see you. And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.